All right, hi everybody, and welcome to the test one test preparation class for the junior and senior high group of this ancient history program of History at Our House. So what we're going to do today is we are going to let the junior high students present their answers to the test preparation sheets so that you can get my feedback on the quality of those answers and you can then get a pretty good measure of what your level of preparedness is for the upcoming test. And as far as high school students go, a little guidance here for those of you who are at that level. You don't get test preparation sheets because basically at this stage of the game, we are assuming that you are in transition towards that independent state, which could be expressed in the form of you going on to college or going to some kind of professional, preparations of some sort, or going out into the workforce. And in that world, you don't get nice little test preparation things. So basically, life tests you and you gotta go. So this is gradually what we do is we remove the floaties. We remove all of the training wheels until, presumably you're 18 or around there, and you are now an independent human being, with the skills that you need in order to proceed from there. And so you're, what you get in, as high school members of the class here is an opportunity in a self-directed manner to scan the work that your peers are performing in the junior high level, and check your notes, check your own understanding, confirm that you know what you should know, because the scope of the material is pretty much the same. What you're going to see on your high school tests, though, is that oftentimes the question will have a little added dimension to it, a little bit more complexity. I'll be looking for more interpretation. I'll be looking for more of your ability to weave things together and draw out the meaning of things. So that's kind of the way that it tends to progress here. Okay, so let's go ahead. What we do is I just bring up the junior high test prep sheets on screen. We're going to go over your answers. This is page one here of your three-page test. And this is your prompt. And so at this level, I'm not giving you the dates. Here again, there's an example kind of the training wheels scenario here. If you're doing the test and you're an upper elementary student, I would put, number two, and I would write 1776. And so that would give you a little extra boost. And then you just write down what happened. But at this level, I'm putting, I'm taking away those training wheels. And it's going to be up to you to be able to decipher this construct, basically, is what it is, this model, and be able to explain it. So let's go ahead and do that. And in particular, what I'm going to be looking for here in the Anchor Fact Timeline of Ancient History is I'm going to be looking for the marriage of fact and meaning. In other words, I don't just want raw facts. I want to see that you understand why the event in question is an anchor fact. So you have to demonstrate that you there's a thing that happened and this is what it means. Okay, so that's the key to it. And just on a procedural level, if you've answered a question, I want you to not raise your hand for the next question, please. Okay, we have enough of a group here that I want to make sure everybody gets multiple opportunities to answer questions. And so when you answer a question, skip the next one. And then on the other hand, if you hear somebody give an answer and you're really eager to also offer your answer, go ahead and do that. I don't mind at all hearing at least two different versions of an answer to a question. And I think each of you will benefit from hearing how, just like when we did the writing paragraph, you can benefit from seeing how somebody else processed an answer. The same thing applies here. It helps to see how different, a fact can be formulated in different ways, and interpreted in different ways. So we're here working as a team, essentially. And so any answer that you offer is good for you, because you will hear what my feedback is on that and make sure that you get to the best possible answer. On the other hand, it's also good for everybody else, because they also can benefit from both your successes and from your mistakes. All right, so let's go. Number one. Let's see what you guys had to say. How about number one, Sophie?
I am here, 2015 and 16.
Okay, I am here, 2015 and 16. All right, let's see what we can make. That's fine. And I would like an answer that had maybe something else to it. Right? I think what we have there is that kind of first formulation from our art appreciation process. And now we want to take it and make sure that we, you know, add the context and give it the significance. Juliet, how could we do that?
This is where we are in history now.
Ooh, nice! This is where we are in history, right? We are here. I am here. This is where I am in history. All right, that's good. What's another way of saying the same thing? Nemo, what about you?
This is the world we live in, and in order to understand it, we must study the past.
Nice. Woo, all right. That's getting to be quite the answer there. Okay, so anything along those lines is what we're looking for here. Okay, I am here. This is where my study of history begins. I am here. What was that one? This is where. There's a lot of so many different ways, but you know that's what I would put. My answer would be: I am here. This is where my study of history begins and ends. Okay? That's present centrism. We are here. If you wanna formulate it collectively, that's fine. And especially with regard to. See, present centrism is not the same as subjectivism. Subjectivism says, okay, if it's, I am here and, you know, history ends with me, and it's my perspective that counts. No, that's subjectivism. That's not present centrism. Present centrism is the world that we live in is our starting point. And that is common to all of us. So that's how we render the study of the past from our vantage point objective. We don't just have it. I mean, I like the I am here part, because the thing that's good about that, and it also helps us to be objective, is that it says, okay, the reason we study is to live, right? The reason we learn is to empower ourselves, and not as a truth. So objectivity is not just collecting a bunch of facts and putting them in a cabinet. That's not objectivity. That's the wrong version. A lot of people have thought in the past that that's what it is. And that's why history is so useless today. So that's the mistake, is to just think of it as facts and facts and facts without the significance. What we need to find is the objective significance. And that starts with us right here and now, embracing the fact, again, the fact that we are here. To be objective, you've got to embrace all the facts, not just some of them. Okay, so that's why number one is our absolute, I mean, that is the number one anchor fact of all of history. So it's so funny because basically, if you don't get that part, there's no point in all the rest. You're just playing some kind of mind game, and it's of no significance whatsoever. So this is the number one anchor fact of all of history. You are here. We are here. This is the world we live in. This is where we study, from where we study history. This is the thing we want to understand. All of those formulations are part of what you want to kind of try to capture in number one there. Okay, so that's the most important one. It's also, in a way, the most challenging one, because it is not a prevalent view that this is, you know, the way to study the past. And so that's very important to do that. All right, number two. Let's go with that now. Theo, please.
1776 AD. The founding fathers write the Declaration of Independence, creating the United States of America, which is now the most important and powerful country in the world.
There we go. All right, that is home run. Okay, anybody want to do another formulation? So here we got the marriage of fact and significance. All right, okay, we've got the fact, got the Declaration of Independence, that's good, but creating the United States, which is the most important country in the world. There we go. Now we know why bother remembering something like the founding fathers created the United States? Of all the things that happened in the past, why bother with that one? Well, what do you mean, why bother? It's the most important country in the world. So if you don't get that, I mean, geez, there's nothing else. Again, see, we're here. Okay, good. What's the most important thing? This thing. Okay, let's keep going. What else is important? Right? That's how we want to proceed in our studies of the world. There is a lot of stuff that's important. There's a lot of stuff that's wonderful to learn, right? But that's kind of the orientation that we need to have. Okay, let's go with number three. All right, Cliff, what's your take on that?
1492 AD, Christopher Columbus discovers America.
Okay, that's our starting point. What could we do to make that a more powerful anchor fact? Anybody here now might be off the top of your head. What could we do? Why is... In a way, what I'm asking here, Cliff, is for you to give me more information about this green line. How is this, for you as a navigator of the past, why does this segment matter so much? That's what I'm asking. Okay? So that this is not just a line, or it's not just a fact by itself, but how does it matter to us? Theo, what's your take on that?
Well, the Founding Fathers find... Sorry, not the Founding Fathers. The Christopher Columbus finds America, paving the way for European settlers, some of which are the ancestors of the Founding Fathers who then create America.
Okay, that's true. That's going to be too much, right, for this particular answer. So how are we going to... What we need, what is the essence? What we need is this is the bridge between us and this... Okay, that's what I'm driving at. Right? These facts over here, this is like an island. And we are way over here on our own island in the present. So how do we bridge that is my question. Cliff, you want to try it?
Well, Christopher Columbus was a European. He brought European ideas over to America, European settlers. And if he wouldn't have discovered America, of course, it probably might have been colonized, but it would have taken a lot longer.
Okay. All right. So wait. That's good. So what you're doing now is we're kind of batting around some ideas. Let's see if we can pin it down. What I would do here is I would say Christopher Columbus in 1492 AD, Christopher Columbus discovered America, bringing Europeans with knowledge of ancient history to the Americas. Okay? He himself had knowledge of ancient history, but, you know, he and the succeeding Europeans brought knowledge of ancient history to America. That's why we have a bridge. Okay? All right, good. Let's do number four. Abby, you're up.
Germanic barbarians invade the Roman Empire and cause the fall of Rome, launching Europe into the Dark Ages.
Okay, that is good. Yeah, but I would like a present-centric formulation here. Right? You've given us a part of the meaning. A part of the meaning of this event is the Dark Ages, but it's not the whole meaning. In order to get the whole meaning, we gotta link it back up to the present. So how can we do that? Okay, because the Dark Ages ended. Juliet?
Rome was sacked by Germanic barbarians in 476 AD. Thus, oops, sorry. Thus, giving the reason for the Renaissance.
Okay, I see what you're shooting for here. You're trying to get, you know, again, forge that bridge, right? Be careful about, we got to be careful here because we need the marriage of fact and significance. And you said Rome was sacked in 476. So be careful about that, right? Rome was sacked multiple times leading up to 476. And then what happened in 476 was the last Roman emperor was deposed. Okay, so that was much more of a ceremonial event, but nonetheless highly significant because at that point, from that point on, there's nobody else calling himself the Emperor of Rome. Okay, so that's what happens in that moment. But what we need is, and this is not easy to do, so I'm glad we're working on it here. Right, what we need is a formulation that bridges the gap between past and present. So the Dark Ages only gets us part of the way. So how can we leap across that distance of 1500 years most, you know, succinctly and essentially? Nemo, what's your try?
In 476 AD, European barbarians sacked Rome and began European history.
Okay, this is a nice one. The idea that in 476 AD, the Roman Empire came to an end, I would rather you say, than sack, again, because sack is a specific thing. The Roman Empire came to an end, giving rise to European history, or European culture. That's a bridge, right there, because you see, European culture, this green line, is continuous all the way to the present, and it also comes across to America, and is embedded even in American values. So that is a present-centric statement, giving rise to European culture. You have now said something that connects us to that event. That's good. That's about as short as it can be. Now, on the other hand, it could be more elaborate if you so chose. Anybody, Theo, you want to try?
Yeah, so maybe 476 AD, the Roman Empire is fully destroyed by European barbarians, ending ancient history and leading to the rise of European civilization.
There, that's nice. So what you did there, which I like very much, is, okay, the Roman Empire falls, bringing an end to ancient history. That's nice. So you've kind of taken this milestone and you're cast back to grab this and hold on to it and say, this is related to all this. And then it ends giving rise to European civilization, the modern thing. That's a gorgeous formulation right there. Okay? So see how that is basically, you know, bridging or bringing together, weaving together as much of history as we can bring together. That's the power of the anchor facts. Okay? So this is the level that we're shooting for here, Nemo. So in answer to your little chats there. So the basic facts are good, and they are the foundation of everything else. So if we don't get those straight, okay, we're in trouble, right? So we've got to do that. But the basic facts are not enough. So we need to be able to state the full significance of them. That's what gives us a powerful awareness of the past and allows us to weave the whole thing together. There's nothing about the past. Here's what, I don't know how much it'll excite you, but the truth of the matter is the entirety of the past is accessible to anybody. Any reasonably intelligent person can know all of it. And it's a tragedy to me that basically nobody knows it. So what? How badly have historians, you know, done their job that something that pretty much everybody can know, nobody knows? Man, it doesn't get any worse than that, right? That's an F. Historians get an F for communicating the value of the past. But it is possible. And you've already got, if you look at this diagram, and you can label this whole thing, you now have a structural framework for putting the whole thing together. It's a beginning. It's only a beginning. Okay? But at your level of understanding, which I'm already witnessing, there's a lot of brain power here. You know, this is not even an average group. This is an above average group for sure. There's a lot of this. Is well within reach, even just this year. Keen, what's your thought?
Regarding how most people can't access the past and don't value history, I'm really surprised at it, because if you look at it seems obvious, looking at any of the great figures in history who have changed the world, think the founding fathers, Martin Luther King Jr., they were students of history. They knew that the only way they were able to do what they did, but some of them don't realize that, and they don't seek to achieve the knowledge required to change.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people do want to do these days. They want to make change, but they can't do it. And I'm surprised they're looking to history and things like that in order to try to be able to change things.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting observation. And you're right, a lot of people want to change the world. It's the kind of thing that gets its way into political slogans. What ends up happening is they change it for the worse. So that's the problem, is because you get the change all right, but it's not good. So there's different kinds of change, right? Change for the better is progress. Change for the worse is decline. And so we get, nowadays we have a strange mix of those is what we get. So it's very hard to read history and kind of think about the trajectory of civilization. But it is possible to decipher it, but you really have to work at it and figure out the fundamentals. But nowadays we have a real mix. You're right that, you know, the people who change history for the better, are always ones that have some historical minded power. The founding fathers are the best example. There are a lot of lesser examples. But abolitionists, for instance, are an excellent example in American history, and civil rights activists as well, to a lesser extent, but still important, are important examples of this. You know, people who are generating progress in society. And you're right that they've got to understand kind of the current of events. They've got to figure out how history has moved and generated the place where they are and what that opportunity is for them to make the world a better place. And each to their own capabilities, right, is summoning something, an understanding that is not commonplace, and they're making progress. That's a good observation. All right, so where did we get to here? Number five. Okay, let's do that one. Sophie, please.
Jesus is born in circa 4 BC, later launching Christianity, the most important religion in history.
Okay, there we go, right? The birth of Jesus leads to the rise of Christianity. And usually we kind of pair that with the fact that this date marks is used in our entire calendar system, right? And our measurement of all historical events are referenced by that date. So it gives you some idea of the historical cultural significance of Christianity. Okay, good. All right, moving along. Six. Our big bridge to the archaic world. Abby.
The Rosetta Stone is found by Napoleon, therefore forging a bridge to archaic Egypt for Egyptologists. I meant to say that earlier.
Okay, you've got it a little bit conflated, I think is the word. Right? So Napoleon didn't find it. Somebody working for him found it. I think it was soldiers in particular. All right, but what we can say is during the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt, the Rosetta Stone is discovered, right? Sometimes we have to kind of formulate it in we have to couch it so that we don't overstate what we know about, you know, a particular thing. So you can kind of surround the fact. You don't have to pin it down that way. Okay, but you had the significance. Timothy, what's your formulation?
Napoleon's men discovered the Rosetta Stone in 1799 AD, which helps us to study and understand the history of ancient Egypt.
Okay, nice. Okay, so that one, I think everybody's getting that bridge pretty well. Juliet, one more.
In 1798, Napoleon conquered Egypt, leading to the discovery of the Rosetta Stone in 1799. This was deciphered by Jean-François Champollion in 1822. This is the key that we continue to use today to uncover the secrets of this ancient civilization.
Okay. When you say this, did you have Egypt before? Did I miss it?
I did say it conquers Egypt, and I did say Rosetta Stone.
Oh, okay. Okay, so Egypt, yeah. It might be grammatically, it might be a little ambiguous. I mean, historically, it's a beauty. It might be a little grammatically ambiguous, okay? So, good. Let's get moving here to number eight. A common way to dismiss something as unimportant is to say, that's ancient history. What perspective about the past does this reveal? How can one do better? Okay. So, Rosie, go ahead. Rosie? Oh, okay. Malfunction there. Let me know when you're ready to go. Nemo, go ahead.
Many people have careless perspective of the past. These people think that the past has nothing to do with them, with the present, and they should get on with life rather than studying it. This is a serious mistake. For if we did know the past, we wouldn't even know how we got here. People should respect and appreciate the past more than they are currently in our modern world.
Okay. All right. Yes. Good. Okay. I like the tone of that answer. It's authoritative in a good way. So good. We apparently missed Mannings and Armour, did we? Okay, I apologize here. Let's just finish with this one and then go back to Mannings and Armour. So let's have some other formulations of that. I like Nemo's kind of prescriptive take here. And I'm sure there's a lot of different ways to express number eight here. Okay, so what are your versions of that? Theo, what's your version?
Saying that's ancient history to dismiss something as unimportant reveals perspective about the past that believes that ancient history is unimportant. One can do better by learning about how to connect ancient history to the present, which gives one a meaningful, useful information.
All right, nicely done. Okay, so that's a little bit more factual in the sense of you're talking about how methodologically we can do it, right? One can do better by learning the connections between the ancient past and the present. So once again, I'm going to suggest that the ultimate answer is a marriage between Nemo's answer and Theo's answer, right? So Theo's got a good statement of the technique, right? The method. And Nemo's got the tone and the value significance, right? So if we can put those together, then we have got it all. Okay? So we can do better by learning to connect the past and present by using a proper method. And therefore, and this is the Nemo part, right? We can learn that the past is how we got to be where we are at all and understand the world that we are living in. All right. This is good. Good stuff. Okay. Both good answers. Let's go back to number seven and perform an act of connection here. So, Rosie, were you trying to answer number seven or, well, whoever? Okay. Go ahead then.
Menes Narmer unifies Upper and Lower Egypt in circa 3000 BC.
Okay, that's definitely our fact. Can you extend that? What's the so what part of that?
It connects us to the thing because we don't have pharaohs anymore. We don't. We're not ruled by one person.
Okay, so now that's an interesting answer. I'm going to give you a little bit of a boost on that one so that you can fill that one out, okay? Because what you're suggesting there is, okay, Mennes Narmer unifies ancient Egypt and, establishing the pattern of archaic life, but we don't follow it anymore. So that's a very interesting way to bridge the past. So it's a, I think I really like that. Because what you're talking about there is, you're talking about the significance of the past can vary. Sometimes the instructional power of the past is, do it like this, because that's what works. That's what's good for human beings. On the other hand, sometimes the instructional benefit of the past is to say, don't do this again. Whatever you do, don't do this. Okay? Don't do it like this. So the, you know, history's got both for us, right? And the truth of the matter is, archaic history's got a lot of don't do these things in it. Which is why it's not classical. Why we don't look back to it and say, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could all just enslave each other and build pyramids day and night, right? Wouldn't that be a great society? So, you know, we just don't look back on archaic civilizations and say, oh, it sure would be nice if we did it that way again. All right, so, you know, this is a neat take. You could also, kind of connect it, in another way. I think perhaps the most fundamental way, would be to say something like, Menes and Narmer unified ancient Egypt circa 3000 BC. In what is essentially the first recorded, validated recorded human event in history. So what you're doing there is, much like we did at the those other junctures where we're talking about, let's say, ancient history ends, European history begins, here we're saying history begins. So that's big, right? Because what you're doing there is, one of the things that you have to do if you want to really command history and is be able to basically put it in a box. See, and so Menes Narmer helps us to put this all in a box. So basically, you know how big the thing is. And once you can get outside something and look at it, you know, you now have a perspective that allows you to basically, you know, you can see the whole thing. So that's one of the reasons why Menes Narmer is one of the anchor facts of history, not just of ancient history, but of all of history. Because without being able to put this boundary condition over here and say, all right, this is as far back as we've got good information, then we just don't know how big this thing is. So it's, all right, starts here, ends here, it's inside. This is our container. Everything goes inside this. Of course, we got, you know, how wide is this and what are the civilizations and so on. There's more information to gather. But that's kind of the importance of Menes Narmer. He gives us that boundary for our studies. We don't go further back than this. I mean, you can study things concerning civilization that is further back than that. There's quite a bit of information concerning things happening in Mesopotamia, things happening perhaps in India and China, so on. But it's got a legendary quality, or it's just religious texts and myths and things like that. So you can go ahead and study those, and they are revealing about, again, primitive societies. You got to decide how much benefit is that. You know, is that something that you're really, really interested in? It could end up being, for some people, it becomes a professional specialization. But it has a tendency to just be facts about ancient stuff. And it's harder and harder to connect it to the present. So this allows us to say, all right, this is where we start. This is all the stuff we can connect to the present. We know how, because we got this, and we studied this, we translated the Rosetta Stone that gave us access to all of this and takes us back to this. So that's pretty cool. Okay, number 9. If the ancient world collapsed in 476 AD and there were the Dark Ages, how do we still know about and learn from ancient history? Okay, Sophie.
After the Dark Ages came the Renaissance, which means the rebirth. During the Renaissance and before, there are written records to learn from. The Renaissance has a lot of information and records which fill in the gaps of ancient history.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. And you're right that in the Renaissance they had kind of records. And as you pointed out, which is also true, they had records before. So, but here's the thing about the Renaissance is they decided to revive that as something to look at and think about. That's the rebirth part. And they said, hey, wait a minute, it's not just the stuff around us, which was pretty dreary at the time, that we should pay attention to. We should actually listen to what those Greeks and Romans had to say. Their civilization is gone, but look at these amazing things they did. So that's the revival. Okay, that's the rebirth part, is that re-embracing of the message that those ancient civilizations have to transmit to us. It was there, as you said, the records existed, but the meaning was submerged. It was dormant. It wasn't alive, and it wasn't animating the society of the Dark Ages. So it had to be brought back to life, literally. Abby, go ahead.
I had just a little part. I wanted to read my answer for the number nine.
Go ahead.
After the Dark Ages came the Renaissance, and during the Renaissance, people embraced and wanted the knowledge of ancient civilizations like the ancient Greeks and Romans. They wrote about what happened to them, therefore providing us with written records of history.
Okay. And in that perspective was transmitted through to modern times. Maybe something like that. Okay, again, to build that bridge. Right? So how do, because remember what I wrote here to get this perfect answer, what I wrote was how do we still know? So we you do need to mention the Renaissance there, but you gotta get back to us here over here, right? So that revival of those ideas and the transmission of the value of ancient culture to the present day is what happened thanks to the Renaissance. Okay, continue. Number 10. When the founding fathers created the United States, they said it was a republic if you can keep it. What did they mean? What parts of ancient history were most important to them in making this determination? Theo, go ahead.
What the founding fathers meant when they said that the United States was a republic if you can keep it was that America could have a government which protected their rights if they didn't destroy it. The parts in ancient history most important to them in making this decision were Rome, whose civilization collapsed after they transitioned from being a republic to an empire, and Athens, whose government of democracy was imperfect, and the majority would always oppress the minority.
All right, so now that's a really interesting one. So, did the majority always oppress the minority? We have to be careful of that. Kind of overstating things like that. Okay? Because it is possible that a majority will enact, laws that are beneficent to all. Even if the minority disagrees, well, they're wrong, and they are in fact benefiting, right? So, for instance, if you enact laws that say that theft and murder is criminal, right? But you have a minority of people that don't want those crimes to be, punished at all. Well, what they're suggesting is to that the society should not protect rights, and then the majority is suggesting that it should protect rights, and so you could get the majority making a judgment that is essentially pro rights. Okay, so that does happen, and so you have to make allowance for that. Democracy is a kind of it's a definitely better than the monarchy or aristocracy in that regard, in the sense that you're pooling the ideas of the entire culture, and you're hoping that that culture is rights oriented, and the Greeks were it to the best of their abilities at an early stage. But ultimately, they couldn't hold that together And they, there were some things they hadn't yet thought of and figured out. So let's be careful about being overcritical of democracy, because we have to make, you know, proper allowances for the positive sides of it, which we'll talk about as well in history. On the other, then what else did I want to say? What I really liked about your answer was your identification that Rome was a republic and thus very important, useful precedent, but that it collapsed. Okay, they collapsed. And that is a big deal was definitely a big deal to the founders. And it was very important to them to set up the American government in a manner that was more sustainable than the Roman one. Now, history ultimately will judge whether or not they succeeded in that capacity, because we haven't gotten far enough into the story here to see. But they did this nonetheless. They did an amazing job. But you're right about the whole point about Rome collapsing as a part of your story, because the Romans had a republic and they couldn't keep it. So that's good stuff. All right. Anybody want to try an alternate formulation? Juliet.
When one of the founding fathers, namely Benjamin Franklin, said the United States was a republic if you can keep it, he meant that he and his colleagues had created a government which protects the right of its people and in which no one holds absolute power. They knew when they made it that it was going to be hard to keep, and history has proven them right. The two parts of ancient history which were most important to them in making this determination were when Athens created a democracy in circa 508 BC and when Rome created a republic in circa 509 BC. This is because they were, they found, the best two forms of government in the world.
Okay, good. That's a good answer as well. And it's pretty complete. But the one thing that I don't think I heard it, correct me if I'm wrong, that Theo had there was that bridge about the Romans losing their republic. So now what you've got is kind of like what Nemo had in his answer, a little bit of a tone to the answer, which says, well, yes, American history shows that it's not easy to maintain rights. And so that's kind of an interpretive thing, right? And I think it is possible to back that up. So it's okay. It kind of gives, a little bit of flavor, and it's basically correct. So you can put that in there, but you've got to have your facts. And the fall of the Roman Republic is the big one. Okay. Because they were talking, that's what the founders were so concerned about when they made a republic. They said, first of all, well, democracy cannot possibly last. And when they looked at the way that various Greek democracies worked, they were very volatile. It's very understandable why a true democracy is volatile, and why even countries, you know, that are similar to the United States, let's say countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, all of the different countries that were settled by the British, for instance, and even other European countries, are relatively stable. And what stabilizes them is not the democratic part. The democratic part is volatile, and it's always going to be volatile. The democratic part is all that yelling that you see going on in the debates, and all of the aspersions being cast, and all of the vilifying, and the demagoguery. The word has the same root as democracy. And so there is a quality, a necessarily kind of ugly quality to the democracy part of any society in our modern ones. And the part that stabilizes that is the aspect in those societies that is the written set of laws, the legal system, the police, the courts, the viability of all of those stabilizing institutions. Welcome back, Timothy. And they exist in other, you know, types of similar forms of government, which you find in places like Canada and Britain and so on, and even France and Germany and so on as well. And those are stabilizing. I don't know, I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but I wanted to give you just a little bit of an extra pointer on the significance of all this. All right, we have a couple more questions to go, so let's finish up. Explain the distinction with examples between classical and archaic ancient cultures. Sophie, go ahead.
An example of archaic history is the ancient Egyptian period. It does not have a direct connection with us today, but it still is important to learn about. The Athenian and Roman period is classical and has direct connections to our lives today. The governments in these classical cultures extremely strongly influence the government we live by today.
Okay, nice. All right, good. That's the one. All right, let's go to number 12. What were the three forms of writing on the Rosetta Stone? How did its discovery lead to the creation of Egyptology? Abby?
The three forms of writing on the Rosetta Stone were ancient Greek, demotic, another kind of Egyptian, and hieroglyphics. The Rosetta Stone led to the creation of Egyptology, as most European historians at that time could still read ancient Greek and were able to translate the other two forms of writing on stone, and they could read written records that the Egyptians had left behind.
Okay. There we go. Nice. Timothy, what's yours?
The three forms of writing on the Rosetta Stone were ancient Greek, another form of Greek known as demotic, and hieroglyphics. The historians of this time period, around 1800, still knew ancient Greek and thus were able to translate it after 22 years of hard work. When people knew how to read hieroglyphics, they were able to understand the ancient Egyptian civilization and 3,000 years of history.
Okay, nice. One correction. Demotic. There is, and you might have been researching this yourself and maybe got into a little bit of a confusion. There is a form of Greek writing called Demotic, but that's not the one on the Rosetta Stone. So that's Demotic with a capital D, if I remember correctly. But the Demotic script of Egypt is unique, and that's the one on the Rosetta Stone. Okay, so there is Demotic Greek writing, but the one on the Rosetta Stone is Demotic Egyptian writing. Okay, so there's such a similarity or parallels between them that it's Demotic. Now, if the class notes are wrong, I got to go in and fix that up. But it should say, can you check for me, Timothy, before we're done for today, if there's an error? Nemo, go ahead.
Jean-Francois Champollion is the one who translated the Rosetta Stone.
Oh, that's...
And the two halves of Egypt?
Okay, wait, that's the bonus questions you're answering. Okay, so 13, Jean-Francois Champollion. All right, number 14, the two halves. Who wants to do that one? Rosie, go ahead.
Upper and lower.
Upper and lower, okay, important. And then finally, what science studies archaic human life, Abby?
Archaeology.
Okay, good. All right, so there you go. You get a flavor for the test here. It's about a page shorter than tests will be in the future. So you're going to expect tests to be more on the order of about 4 pages long. So this is just kind of a little, you know, taste. And this is about the level of difficulty at the junior high level. And like I said, the high school questions tend to be more open-ended. And I tend to be more demanding in terms of what I'm seeing you kind of bring to bear. And I want to see more integration. I want to see more, understanding exhibited and that kind of stuff. But so this is basically what it's at. I will post the test to the class webpage, again, within about, say, half an hour or so. So look for that. And you can take it anytime. So good luck with it. Any last questions or comments? Okay, well, my final comment is congratulations on your efforts. I was impressed, and as I've been all throughout the first 6 weeks here. So good work, and I think you guys are in strong position to be moving ahead, basically, in a very productive way over the coming weeks. So well done. Thanks, everybody. Have a good weekend.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you, Mr. Powell.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. You got-